This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Kong, Skull Island, The Ottoman Lieutenant, and My Scientology Movie. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course the home cinema roundup with the spotlight on Disney's Moana. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news I want to talk about is just the success of Logan, and I'll talk a little bit more about the actual numbers later on in the show when I do the box office segment, but let's talk about Logan as a success and what that means for superhero movies, because this is actually now the second year in a row that we have had a major superhero movie success from Fox in that X-Men universe that's R-rated. Now, I know a lot of people, when they first heard that Logan was going to be rated R, they lost their minds. They thought it was awesome because they're like, oh, good, we can finally see Wolverine as he's meant to be, going berserk and ripping heads off and seeing blood flying. And yeah, you get to see that in Logan. But let me throw a little bit of caution out there. One of the things that Hollywood does is it is completely dependent on what has just happened. Hollywood looks at stuff, and especially when you're talking superhero movies, where they're throwing $100 million, $200 million at these movies. I mean, you're not talking about doing a $20 or $30 million film. You're talking about big numbers. And when you get a success, they then try to replicate that success. Case in point, look at DC with The Man of Steel. They saw all that success from the Nolan Batman movies, and they said, oh, we need dark, gritty Superman. And so they made this Man of Steel movie that was marginally okay, but it had its problems, but it really didn't work as this grim, heavy, downtrodden film. And they actually ran into that before, back when Tim Burton was making Batman movies and they were very dark. They said, let's make a dark Superman movie. And then Superman Lives went into development hell for years, and Nick Cage was going to play him. But the whole point is that whenever you have a string of successes, then everything that comes after it tries to duplicate that. And you, like I said, you saw that with the Nolanverse. You quite frankly saw that with the Marvel Studios stuff. Marvel Studios is a little more lighthearted. It's a little more tongue-in-cheek. It has a little more comedy in it. And that's how you end up getting a goofy movie like Green Lantern, which I thought was okay, but still, Green Lantern was not the hit that they wanted it to be, even though it was trying to follow that Marvel formula. That's also why it took so long to get a Wolverine movie that was rated R and violent, because all the other X-Men movies were rated PG-13. They go with what was done before. Now, a lot of people are comparing this to Deadpool. Now, here's the problem. Deadpool and Logan, two totally different movies. I mean, they couldn't be any more different. 180 degrees out of phase. Deadpool's essentially a broad comedy. Logan is a modern Western, like Unforgiven. And people are acting like this is the first time they've ever made R-rated superhero movies. And that's not true. I mean, look at The Watchmen that came out 10 years ago. That was an R-rated movie. You had The Punisher, both the original one back in the 80s with Dolph Lundgren and the reboot they did in like 2005. Now you might sit there and be like, Kevin, Watchmen underplayed and The Punisher was not a big hit. But that's not to say that superhero movies and comic book movies in general, they've done plenty of R-rated superhero movies and stuff that's based on comic books like The Crow or Spawn or Blade, Sin City, 300. 300 was a massive success. Wanted was a big success. Yeah, Kick-Ass did okay, but stuff like Kingsman and even something like the Matrix series, which isn't based on a comic book, but it's authentically a comic book superhero type movie. It's not that these things haven't been seen before, it's just they haven't been seen really in the giant, highly popular PG-13 characters. Now, what I'm afraid you're going to have is you're going to have the segmented section of superhero movies where sort of like the pop entertainment stuff's done by Marvel Studios, which is Disney. DC is going to be doing these dark brooding films, and Fox is now going to go straight into R-rated stuff, which is fine. But let's just make a decent movie. Do we need an R-rated X-Men? No. Do we need something better than X-Men Apocalypse? Yeah. The other piece of news is just some weird little oddity. Apparently, in the new Disney film, Beauty and the Beast, which comes out next week, I haven't seen it yet. I'll be checking it out earlier in the week. But apparently, Josh Gad's character is overtly gay in the movie. And there are people that are causing problems. Like, Russia is saying they're not going to show the film. Russia as a country. And there's like a theater in Alabama that refuses to show it. Accidentally booked a drag queen movie instead, which was kind of insane. But they refused to show a Disney movie with a gay character in it. And there's a question, is he overtly gay? Do they sit there and have him say, I'm gay, and then make out with Gaston? I don't think they do. But you can definitely tell that there's more feelings than friendship between, at least maybe not reciprocated, but this guy has a big man crush on Gaston. But really, seriously, is this the first gay character in Disney? I mean, what about Lumiere and Cogsworth? I thought that they're life mates in this movie. Or look at, like, you know, if this character that Josh Gad plays is gay because he has a fixation on his boss, what about Smee from Peter Pan? Smee certainly has a man crush on Captain Hook. Or even look at Scar from The Lion King. There's a lot of people who talked about whether or not he was gay because of the way he was played by Jeremy Irons and the fact that he was ousted from the pride and wasn't allowed near the ladies. And also, well, I mean, look, have you seen Snow White, the original Snow White? When that guy shows up, not the manliest Prince Charming. We saw this happen as well with Finding Dory, and it didn't turn out to be that way in the movie. It just happened to be the way they cut the trailer together, but it looked like there were two women pushing a baby carriage. And people are like, oh my God, are they showing lesbians and Finding Dory? I'm like, did you do realize that the woman who does the voice for Dory is a lesbian? I mean, we got to get over this, people. This is just absurdity here. And I don't think this protest is going to go anywhere. And you know what? If you don't want to watch a Disney movie or book a Disney movie because there might be a gay character in it, good riddance. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit really quickly is Personal Shopper. Now, it actually opened this week, very limited, in like 4 theaters, and it's going to be rolling out over the next couple weeks throughout the country.
My twin brother Lewis died here.
It's been 95 days.
We made this oath. Whoever died first would send the other a sign.
From the afterlife.
Has that always been there?
Lewis, are you here?
Now, this is directed by the guy who did The Clouds of Sils Maria, which kind of put Kristen Stewart, she was getting back on the map already after her devastating Twilight career. But she won an award that, like, I don't think any American has ever won or hasn't won for years for Clouds of Sils Maria. And this is a spotlight on Kristen Stewart. I'm curious to see this because it's sort of this Hitchcockian thriller, and I like that sort of thing, maybe a haunted house type story. It looks really creepy, and I'm looking forward to it. My big thing with Kristen Stewart is I want to see her play against type sometime. I don't want her to be the put-upon, angsty character, which even in something like Clouds of Sils Maria, she kind of was. And you see that in the trailer where she's sort of twitching and everything. And so all these tics that we got annoyed with the Twilight movies still bother me. Play somebody aggressive and who does not sit around being meek and weeping and twitching around time. That's my big thing, although this movie does look interesting. The next one I want to talk about is Deadpool 2. Which we got a quick teaser, surprising teaser in front of Logan last weekend. It opens on March 2nd of next year.
Wow, nice suit.
Zip it, Stanley!
Oh, Jesus. Oh, that's not good. No, no, no. Oh, you're not going to walk that one off. Oh, that's so gross. Oh,
The gist is he's walking down the street and he hears somebody getting attacked and he spends forever in a phone booth changing. It's a very funny trailer, but it also demonstrates why Deadpool was funny and why Deadpool worked and why you don't have to spend $200 million on it. The trailer's like 3 minutes long. Half of it's him in the phone booth changing. It's absurd. It's silly, but you just have to have the set around him. You don't need big explosions or special effects to make Deadpool funny. That's why you could make that movie for $58 million or whatever it was made last year, and why we don't need $150 million or $200 million to do Deadpool 2, which might be a downfall. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about my Scientology movie. I can see a new horizon underneath the Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about my Scientology movie. This is a documentary, and it comes out this week in limited release, and you're going to see it rolling out throughout the country. It's done very, very well on the festival circuit. And it is the latest attempt to dissect and deconstruct and get into the minds of Scientologists in general. After repeated rebukes by the Church of Scientology to participate in a documentary, filmmaker Louis Theroux takes a different approach on an exposé.
Scientology.
A religion created by a sci-fi writer, run by a mysterious leader, David Miscavige.
So this is my chance to experience Scientology firsthand.
You need to leave.
How are you doing, Mr. Squirrel?
You guys are trespassing.
Got anything to say?
It's okay, we have a permit.
Why are you here?
He's right behind us now.
We have their attention.
Why are they doing this?
It's just not like any church that you could think of.
People have looked askance at Scientology for years. I've never really paid a whole lot of attention to it because I really don't care. I'm not all worried that Tom Cruise is being exploited or John Travolta or anybody like that. And the people who do get caught up in Scientology is it's distressing if you have a family member, sure. And it is absolutely a cult type of religion. I mean, you can say, well, it's a religion, not a cult, because of the way, but you look at their practices, and it definitely has a lot of cult status to it. It's also very small. People, with the amount of attention it gets, I think they say in the movie, it's only like 20, 30,000 people that are involved in this, which again makes it pretty small. The thing is, they're very rich. You got a lot of rich people in there, and that's why they have so much money. And if you go back to the history of Scientology, as far as I understand it, this was something that was set up by L. Ron Hubbard partly to fund himself. And I believe that he spent a lot of his later years on a boat in the sea living in international waters because he had tax evasion issues because the place wasn't considered a church yet. It was considered a business. And it wasn't until after he died that it got a religious, you know, church affiliation status. But I had heard the story, and this might be completely apocryphal, but I kind of think it's interesting, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the way it was, that there was this lunch that L. Ron Hubbard and I think Robert Heinlein, as the story goes, had lunch one day, and they were talking about popularity and charisma and leadership, and L. Ron Hubbard said that you could create a religion. And it was he almost did it on a bet from Robert Heinlein, and then just kind of followed through. He got kind of caught up in it, and then it became a source of wealth for him because his sci-fi writing had dwindled a bit. And I remember as a kid seeing ads for Dianetics on daytime TV, like in the 70s and 80s, and not knowing anything about it. Now, this movie itself is kind of fascinating because you can't get into the Scientology center. They won't cooperate with you. Not to say that there aren't videos and movies and documentaries about Scientology, but they're all made internally. And if you go watch some of those on the internet, they're kind of bonkers, really. They are insane. So you're not going to get any sort of critical documentary of this, or even like an unbiased look at it, because they're so closed with their efforts. I mean, and it's not a big enough religion. It's not like the Catholic Church, where you can do an expose on the Catholic Church, absolutely, without a problem. But getting access to the Vatican might be a little harder. And that's kind of what this is. The Scientology Center in LA is their Vatican. But what he does is, instead of trying to break into Scientology or send somebody in as a mole, he basically talks to people who had left. And there was a big exodus back in the mid-2000s, and it was tied a lot to some very negative press that Scientology got, not just from Tom Cruise and some of the issues he had, but also with the South Park episode, which I tried to find a clip, but it's actually all on South Park Studios. But they broke down Scientology pretty dramatically, and it in fact caused a schism within South Park, because it caused Isaac Hayes, who was a member of the Church of Scientology, to quit the show, even though he'd done it for something like 10-15 years. Now, the thing that's interesting about that is Trey Parker and Matt Stone, I think it was Trey Parker, who said, he's like, look, we've made fun of everybody, and you had no problem going after like the Christians, but oh, go after Scientology and you suddenly have to quit the show. And he just kind of called out as a hypocrite. And of course, then they killed off the character of Chef, and then Isaac Hayes ended up passing away. The point being is the Scientologists take this very seriously. And because they're so small, they're controlled in their own environment. And this movie shows him basically taking reports of what people who had left were talking about, and then sort of poking the bear a bit in terms of showing up at their center and trying to get confronted by their security, trying to get confronted by their people that are called, they have special names for them, squirrel hunters and people like that, who are trying to bait them into causing problems. It's a fascinating look at not Scientology, because it doesn't give that inside look, but it's a fascinating look at what happens to people if they poke too hard at Scientology. And we saw that with South Park. Apparently South Park, they suffered some attacks from the Church of Scientology. Now, of course, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, they didn't care. They just made more obnoxious stuff about it. But you did have the Scientologists coming after them, talking against them. And this doesn't happen to everybody. Like here's a clip. This is a bit from the show, The IT Crowd, where they finally kind of took on Scientology. They did an episode on it. I don't know if anything ever happened to them. But here's the bit where the boss goes into it.
Hello, I'm Douglas Renham. I'm not a scientist, but I do have a better understanding of what space is than any scientist living today. Where did I gain these insights? From this man, the founder of Spaceology, Beth Gaga Shaggy. No relation to either Lady Gaga or Shaggy, is the founder of Spaceology, a religion, not a cult. In other words, when it comes to space, he's the man with his head screwed on tight. This is what he told me when I met him on holiday 2 weeks ago.
Space is invisible mind dust, and stars are but wishes.
I had to play that because I'm a huge fan of the IT Crowd, but also it shows that it's not just South Park that makes fun of Scientology or is critical of Scientology. A lot of people consider it bonkers. Now, I don't think I'm going to be suddenly stalked by Scientologists. Part of it is I live in Ohio. It's an LA, real LA-centric thing, even though there's Scientologists in Ohio, but I really don't think I'm going to have people videotaping me and following me around just because I'm talking about it critically on the radio. They have way too many critics out there to spend that much time. But I imagine if I start really poking into Scientology, I would run into some resistance. The point being, this is a fascinating but very lighthearted, sort of British humorous look at the effects of being critical of Scientology, of looking into this quote-unquote religion cult. Like Douglas Renholm says, it's a religion, not a cult. And it's all based on these reports that are substantiated among the people who'd left, but of course are vehemently denied by anybody involved in Scientology. But it's kind of terrifying what's gone on. And it shows the real aggressive nature of Scientology didn't take off until after L. Ron Hubbard died. And this other guy took over, who is now in charge of it. It's not meant to show how bonkers it is. If you want, go watch Trapped in the Closet, which is the Scientology episode of South Park. You can get it on South Park Studios and watch it live on streaming. That's how bonkers Scientology is. It's not dissecting their religion. It's dissecting how they react to people who even just want to critically look at things. So it's a fascinating movie, definitely worth checking out, either on demand or if it gets to your local theater. So my Scientology movie totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Kong, Skull Island, and the Ottoman Lieutenant. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
King Kong, you know the name of King Kong, you know the fame of King Kong.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. Continuing with the movie reviews, let's talk about Kong, Skull Island. At the tail end of the Vietnam War, a research expedition gets stranded on a mysterious island populated with massive monsters.
These are photos of an island in the South Pacific.
The place where myth and science meet. I see trouble
on the way. Is that a monkey?
Come out!
You knew that thing was out here?
I'm sorry for your men, Colonel. But if you want to make their sacrifice worthwhile, get us home with proof.
One of my favorite old movies, classic old movies, is King Kong. I think King Kong, the original, back in 1933, is a brilliant film. I mean, absolutely brilliant, and it's actually quite good even today. It's a fascinating movie, and amazing when you consider the technology of the time. Of course, it was using stop motion for King Kong and a big prosthetic hand that comes in and grabs Fay Wray. And that's what she's best known for. Fay Wray was actually a really great actress, and she was very game and sexy and spunky. Hers, the screaming girl in the original King Kong, doesn't do her justice as an actress, but that's what she's best known for. I remember seeing the original King Kong. I was like in high school or college, and I really, really loved it. And they've never really been able to recapture that, the awesomeness that was King Kong. I mean, of course you had the remake from 1976, and that's terrible. The Dino De Laurentiis one. I mean, it's back when it was trying to go big, and it just doesn't work. It gets real cheesy. The technology wasn't quite there, and so they ended up with the blue screen versions of a guy in a gorilla suit, even though they built a 50-foot ape, but the model never worked. It was sort of like the shark in Jaws. They, of course, have tried other ones like King Kong Lives and these other stuff through the 80s. And of course, the Japanese kaiju movies with like Godzilla versus King Kong or King Kong versus Godzilla with Doctor Who, actually, was one of the characters, H-U, Doctor Who. It wasn't until Peter Jackson decided to remake King Kong after doing the Lord of the Rings films that it actually had a chance. And I remember my comment back then, my mantra back then was King Kong too long. And it totally was. It was a great movie. If they would have cut an hour off the screen time, even then, I mean, it's like 3 hours plus. And he was coming right off of Lord of the Rings, which Lord of the Rings Return of the King was like 18 hours in the theater anyways. I mean, 3 hours of Lord of the Rings, the Return of the King was the ending. And so he just said, well, I spent 3 hours ending the end of this movie, so let's go ahead and do 3 hours of King Kong. It just should have been edited down because they don't even get to the island. They don't even get to Skull Island for an hour in the movie. I took my oldest son at the time because he was always asking me, is there a dinosaur in this movie? He was 4 at the time. And I'd be like, no, there's no dinosaur in this movie. And he's like, okay. And then I'd go to the movie. But I got the pass for King Kong and had a picture of a dinosaur on it. And he walks up to me. He's a dad. There's a dinosaur in this movie. So I had to go take him. But I then took him like after it opened. And I said, because it was PG-13 at the time. And even I wasn't irresponsible enough to take a 4-year-old to that without checking it out first. And so I went. I went to the theater and I said, I want the tickets for the show that's playing right now. The one that's an hour in. I don't want to see the first hour. I just want to see him when they get to Skull Island and all the effects are going on. Peter Jackson's King Kong was most groundbreaking because of visual effects. And it still looks really cool, even though it's 12 years old. This one is not a sequel to that. And that's kind of one of the things I appreciate the most. They're sort of rebooting the MonsterVerse franchise, and they're rebooting it with King Kong. And so this original movie doesn't exist. The one from the 30s doesn't exist. The one from 1976 doesn't exist. The one from 2005 doesn't exist. This is a brand new King Kong movie. It takes place in the Vietnam War. And that's significant because there's a lot of Apocalypse Now associated comments to it. Even if you go look at the poster art, they are completely playing off Apocalypse Now. And that's because it's saying something about the Vietnam War, and it's the characters. And then I think I appreciate this because one of the characters is Samuel L. Jackson, who plays the military leader who is their protection as they go onto this island. And some of the decisions he makes that kind of put him in a very much of a gray character, even sometimes an antagonistic point, you can see where he's coming from as somebody who was dealing with the blowback from Vietnam, being the first war that America couldn't chalk up in the win columns, you know, the first war that really had us with egg on our face and pulling out and not accomplishing the goal that we had set out to accomplish. And there's reasons for that. But it really deals with the different attitudes during Vietnam, and you see the military attitude and the press's attitude and scientific attitude and the government's attitude. Everybody has their own agenda on this mission, and it shows why it's so hard to get things done. So, I mean, it's a neat deconstruction of the end of Vietnam, but it's also an awesome monster movie. Kong is amazing in this film. The special effects were 12 years past Peter Jackson's King Kong, which was amazing in its own rights. The special effects you see in this movie are amazing. And the other thing is the pacing of the film. Unlike the King Kong remake in 2005, you don't have to wait around for an hour for something to happen. I mean, they're constantly running into things, and there's other monsters on this island that they're facing, and that's what makes it fun. It's just a crazy brass knuckles jungle adventure on top of any sort of subtext you want to take about Vietnam and politics. And on top of this, it also has a great cast. I mean, like I already mentioned, Samuel L. Jackson. You got Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston as sort of like the heroes. One's a tracker, one's a journalist. Then you've got John Goodman as one of the scientists who's searching for Kong. And the best part is John C. Reilly basically playing a version of modern day hobo beard David Letterman as this American pilot who had crashed on the island back during the end of World War II. And he's hilarious in this movie, but authentically empathetic. I mean, there's actually something there. It's not just him being goofy. But here's a guy who's severely traumatized, not just for being in war, but then being stuck on an island with a giant ape and crazy native people for 30 years. And there's a certain amount of pathos under his character, which is really very touching. But he's also hilarious. Ultimately, Kong Skull Island is a great load of fun. I had a blast watching this one. It totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Ottoman Lieutenant. A young nurse from Philadelphia travels to the Ottoman Empire during the buildup of World War I and finds herself in a love triangle with a lieutenant in the local army and the doctor running the hospital in a remote mission.
I'd like to volunteer my services.
You want to be a nurse here?
You need nurses, don't you?
This is no place for a woman. This war is going to split Anatolia down the middle. The Armenians on one side and the Turks on the other.
You have your mission, Doctor, and I have mine.
My mission is saving lives.
Just because I wear a uniform and carry a gun, that makes me a killer?
Yes.
I just wanted an excuse to see you again.
In a lot of ways, this reminds me of A Bitter Harvest. Where The Bitter Harvest was about the starvation in the Ukraine, this is about the lead-up and build-up to World War I outside of American influence. And this is before World War I actually kicks off, but there's escalating tensions, and of course then she's kind of caught in it. Now, at its heart, it's a love story. So, again, kind of like not my cup of tea. And the girl who plays the lead, Hera Hilmer, I think is her name, she's not really very good. I mean, she's flat in everything she does. She's not a very good actress, and she doesn't bring any sort of life to the role. Josh Hartnett plays the doctor, and the other guy who plays the Ottoman lieutenant, they at least have a certain amount of acting ability. And Ben Kingsley's in it as an older doctor who has had tragedy in his own life. And of course, he's great. Ben Kingsley's great in everything he does, whether it's a good movie or bad. And he's been in a lot of crap. But this movie, it's ultimately a love story. It feels like a Regency romance that takes place in World War I. It's less about the politics and the workings of the tensions that were going on in the Ottoman Empire at World War I. It was more about this woman who who she's a Christian and she loves this guy in the army who's a Muslim, but she also loves the Christian doctor who runs the mission. So she's all torn, and it's these epic, beautiful landscapes. So it feels very much like something that would have been seen on the Hallmark Channel with a little bit bigger of a budget. And I feel about the same way as I did it with The Bitter Harvest. It's not a great movie. It's serviceable for what it is. And if you want that love triangle wartime film, you'll get that. The biggest stumbling block for me was the actress. I didn't think she was that good because it's her movie. And it really brings it down a bit. But still, it's out there and you can check it out, even though I think it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about a replay of some James Bond stuff I've been watching. Also, the weekly box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Moana. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. This is the final segment, and I'm going to be talking about a little bit of a diversion. It's not something that's out in theaters right now. It's James Bond, and James Bond is always a popular thing, especially for me. Also, we haven't heard yet about traction for a new Bond film. I mean, are they actually working on one? Are we going to get a new one? Are we going to spend the $50 million that Daniel Craig wants? Are we going to recast it? Who knows? My biggest problem with the Bond films that they went in the direction post Quantum of Solace was they're putting too much relevance on Bond. They're making him a developing character, and you can only develop a character so much. You can develop him over 3 or 4 or 5 films, but at some point it's going to feel like you're just throwing things in his way, and he can't overcome anything, because you want Bond to be somewhat damaged. That's what makes him work as a cold-hearted spy. But going back to the original James Bond, I had shown my kids the whole Bond movie before Skyfall actually came out. I showed them all movies, and there at the time, I think there was, 22? There were 22 Bond movies, and we showed it to them over the course of 4th of July week back in 2012. And a year or two ago, I got for Christmas the Bond Blu-ray box set, the 50 Years of Bond box set. But I want to make sure the discs work, and it's been 5 years since I've watched all the Bond movies, so I'm just kind of cycling through them. I've now finished what I consider the classic Sean Connery Bonds.
James Bond is in operation. 007. Danger sign for the world's most famous gentleman agent with a license to kill and license to thrill. 007, guarantee sign of prompt delivery, night and day service.
Obviously, I'm not talking about Never Say Never Again, because that's sort of an offshoot on its own. It's not even in the Bond universe that exists from Eon Productions. And I'm also not talking about On Her Majesty's Secret Service, because that has George Lazenby, or Diamonds Are Forever, because that was just a one-off, basically, where Sean Connery came back just for a charity donation. And that's a transitional period. But when you look at the films from Dr. No to You Only Live Twice, that's classic Bond, and that galvanized the film world to that setting. And when you watch those all in a row within a couple days or even just a couple weeks, you can tell that Sean Connery is a great Bond. He originated the character, and most people say he's the perfect Bond, but most people tend to like whoever they saw first. I grew up watching Roger Moore. The first Bond movie I saw in the theaters was Moonraker, and I was like 7 or 8, and I liked those movies, and I always liked Roger Moore quite a bit. I knew somebody who had been introduced to Timothy Dalton, and they really liked Timothy Dalton. So it just depends on who you're introduced to. But, you know, taking yourself back from that and looking at the Bond, it's not what Ian Fleming originally envisioned. I mean, he was going for a David Niven type, but a much thinner, taller, a different character, not as much of a scoundrel or as Sean Connery was. But he kind of made it his own, and it didn't gel. The Bond character and the Bond presence didn't gel until about Goldfinger. Doctor No is really uneven at times because it's the first one. They really don't know exactly how it works and they're feeling some things out. And from Russia with Love, which is my favorite one of the Sean Connery series, I just like that because it's just a good, solid spy movie and it totally works in that sense. It even has some freaky henchmen and some gadgets. It's ultimately at its heart just a spy thriller. Oddly, my least favorite of the batch are Goldfinger and Thunderball. I think he's a lousy spy, especially in Goldfinger. He's a terrible spy, and I think they're a little over the top, even silly. But even today, they're the most popular Bond film ever. I mean, if you adjust for inflation, they're almost twice the gross of Skyfall. But as they get more James Bond-ish, the worse of a spy he is. He's a real lousy spy in Goldfinger. And he's a real man whore in these movies, too. I mean, I just watched the trailer for Thunderball. They just list all the women that he bangs. And sometimes it's an opportunity. He's like, hey, look, there's a secretary, excuse me, a Russian diplomat who is going to go blow up a nuclear weapon. I'm going to go bang this girl. Can you wait around for a little bit? I'll be there in about 10 minutes. So it's so much in its time. It's so much in its 60s. And you can't judge it based on modern norms and modern morals. And then as it all ends with You Only Live Twice, which is a great Bond movie. And part of the reason it's so great is because it has Blofeld. It's the most iconic Blofeld we've seen. It's what Dr. Evil was based on. It's got all those Austin Powers reference, like the underground volcano where his evil lair is. It's very Bond, but it's also completely ridiculous. And it's extremely racist, especially making Bond Japanese, which it doesn't serve the story at all to have Bond with that stupid wig and bad eye makeup. If you're at all a fan of these movies, go back and rewatch this from the 60s because it's set the tone and they're great films. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk a little bit about the box office. The two things that I predicted was that Logan was going to make $70 million at the box office and Moonlight might jump into the top 10. I was wrong on both counts, but Logan did extremely well. It did better than that. It did $88 million, which is a great, especially for March. A great number. Now, Moonlight didn't make it in the top 10, but it did make $2.3 million, which is like 10% of its gross in all of its life, post-Oscar win, which is great for it. So that's some good traction there. Now, this week, I think Kong is going up against Logan. I think they're going to be pretty close. I think Kong's going to win. Now, I saw a analysis of it on a website, and they said, well, you know, Kong doesn't serve the R-rated demographic that Logan does. Well, no, most people, the R-rated demographic, first of all, they saw it last week, but the R-rated demographic is not something that everyone goes for necessarily. Certainly don't feel like Kong is pulling its punches because it's PG-13. It's a crazy smackdown of a movie. But yeah, I still think Kong's going to win with $45 million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The one I want to spotlight is Disney's Moana, which came out on Blu-ray on Tuesday.
Maui, shapeshifter, demigod of the wind and sea, I am
hero of men.
What?
It's actually Maui, shapeshifter, demigod of the wind and sea, hero of men. I interrupted from the top. Hero of men. Go. I'm not going on a mission with some little girl.
The ocean is a friend of mine.
First, we've got to go through a whole ocean of bad.
Before I talked about anything with the special features, this is a charming, wonderful movie. And it continues a tradition of great, wonderful, charming movies from Disney Animation, which has finally kind of got itself back on its feet after a little bit of a rough time in the 2000s, going from cel animation to CGI animation. And even then, some of the CGI stuff was a little bit wonky and uneven, like Chicken Little, which I thought was fun, and Meet the Robinsons. But it really didn't kick off until kind of post-Tangled. It was really Frozen that really galvanized it, but you also had Wreck-It Ralph and then, you know, stuff like Big Hero 6. And of course, Zootopia last year kind of usurped Moana. And that's a shame because Moana is a wonderful little movie, but Zootopia kind of just stole its thunder, especially at the Academy Awards. But if you haven't seen Moana, even if you have, get the Blu-ray, watch it in HD. It is gorgeous. If you've ever been to Polynesia, you will know how gorgeous it is and how realistic the water and the sky and the lush greenery looks. It's a brilliant movie from a technical standpoint, but also from a story standpoint. It's very charming. And it's nice to see a movie that's not about a princess whose main goal is to get Prince Charming. Of course, there's a swath of special features, plenty of stuff. You got the commentary, you got deleted scenes. Whenever you get deleted scenes in an animated movie, it's all like storyboards and previs, which is kind of hard to watch those. But you also have, you know, some behind the scenes stuff. You have talking about the music videos. You have them talking to Lin-Manuel Miranda, who does a lot of the music, the songs for it. But you also have a look at the islands. This is like a 30 or 45 minute travelogue about the islands and how they work into the movie. And they took a trip there. That was tough. Yeah. I had to go to Polynesia. Sorry, honey. But it has some neat little things in there too. It doesn't have a ton of unique stuff, but there's plenty of special features and a lot of stuff you've seen in Disney movies. You have a multi-language version of one of the songs, and it's kind of amazing how close they get the voice from each of the language versions of it. All sound like the original Moana, but there's also a look at all the little Easter eggs throughout the movie. But the stuff that I found the best in this, of course, were the cartoons, the individual cartoons. Of course, you have the short film Inner Workings, which was released theatrically with it, which is an amazing movie. Another one of these great short films, and it's a shame this didn't get nominated for an Academy Award as an animated, because I thought that the animated short films were a little bit soft this year in the Academy Awards. It should have gotten it. And then they have a short cartoon. It's a Maui mini movie called Gone Fishing, which is just a little bit of an extra tease of Maui and Moana, just sort of sparring a bit. It's a charming thing, but it's a very comprehensive Blu-ray, not a whole bunch of special features that are very different from the norm, but that's okay because the norm that Disney gives you in their Blu-rays are usually pretty awesome. The other ones that are out this week that are worth talking about are Jackie, which of course, big award loser at the Academy. There's Incarnate, which is a terrible movie, not worth seeing at all. Trespass Against Us, which I covered a couple weeks ago with Michael Fassbender and Brendan Gleeson. And then Miss Hakusai, which is not a kids movie, but it is an animated film from Japan released by GK Kids, even though it's not a kids movie. That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Beauty and the Beast, The Belko Experiment, and T2 Trainspotting. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.